Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck, and I am your host for the weekend show. Also, your host throughout the week at our website, kereport.com, as well as our podcast, Corlin Economics Report. It was another very busy week for us. Lot of editorials, lot of company updates. So please, everybody who's listening on the radio or who just tunes in on the weekend, take a little bit of time and go back and click on especially some of those company updates, as well as maybe find some of your favorite analysts that I bring on and follow along with them. Also, please, everyone, keep in touch, fleck@kereport.com. I love hearing from each and every one of you. I'm kicking off this weekend show with Jesse Felder, founder and editor of the Felder Report. Now, Jesse, it was a busy week this week in terms of news out of the Fed, out of even the U.S. government, and a lot of data that has been trickling out in terms of U.S. economics. And quite frankly, the U.S. economy still is doing pretty well. This rebound seems to be underway, even though we saw the GDP number that was released this week miss estimates. It was still over 6%. Jesse, out of this data, what's been catching your eye?
Well, I'm still just, you know, monitoring a lot of the signs of inflation. You know, we've seen commodities prices just scream higher. And there was a great chart. I can't remember which one of the major brokers put it out, but it's basically just the number of companies on conference calls talking about inflation. And it's just screamed higher this quarter to levels we've literally, never seen before in the 20 years that they've been following this data. So literally companies in all sectors are talking about supply constraints and rising cost pressures. And it's just astounding to me that the Fed is so confident in calling these inflationary pressures transitory when, you know, from everything I look at, inflationary pressures don't show any signs of abating anytime soon.
How long can the Fed, do you think, stay with that narrative of saying this inflation, it is transitory? Because in all fairness, look, last year at this time, the world was a very different place, especially when it comes to the economy. So how long can they use that argument that inflation's transitory?
Well, I think, you know, once we get through these few months where, you know, the quote unquote base effects are really making numbers look, you know, much higher than they otherwise would. You know, if we still have strong inflationary pressures into the fall, then I think the pressure is going to be on the Fed to address it. Now, there's two things, you know, that I really do think that, you know, over the intermediate to long term, are really going to maybe come back and bite the Fed in terms of narratives around policy. And those are, one, the Fed has been exacerbating wealth inequality for a long time now, at least the last, you know, 10 years or so. Now, that is going to create potentially political problems for the Fed in continuing to pursue the extreme experimental monetary policy they've been pursuing since the financial crisis. Now, at the same time, too, the Fed over the last 12 months, you know, through this rethink of policy has said we want inflation to run hot. They've changed their inflation targeting such that they're no longer going to try and cap inflation at 2%, but they want it to average 2%. And that means it needs to be higher than 2% as often as it is lower than 2%. And I think we're already seeing problems with that policy. We're seeing food costs, you know, scream higher, gas costs. And so for people that are out of work or, you know, in the lower income branches, even if they do have a job, you're seeing, incomes have been stagnating, obviously, for 40 plus years now. And now we're seeing that cost of living go screaming higher, not to mention the cost of buying a home. I mean, so many people are being completely just priced out of the market. And, all of these things come back to Fed policy and, are going to be problematic for the Fed at some point.
So it's not just the Fed either. It is also the U.S. government, all governments around the world that are continuing to pump money into the system or into the market. But Jesse, what do you think it'll take to change the Fed's course? If they said they're okay with higher inflation, we're getting higher inflation. A lot of people are saying, well, if a market crash happens, then they're going to be more aggressive. What's it going to take for them to wind back some of this policy?
Well, you know, my friend Bill Fleckenstein has said eventually the bond market will take the printing press away from the Fed. And that's basically, you know, if interest rates start rising, and really, it comes back to inflation. You know, the Fed believes they can always, it's a lot easier for them to battle rising inflation than it is for them to battle deflation. And this is why we've seen this rethink is, you know, the zero lower bound of policy is where the Fed becomes impotent. You lower rates to zero, you buy a bunch of bonds, and that's basically all you can do. And you reach the limits of monetary policy. And so that's why the Fed has said we need to create inflation because we're not comfortable reaching the limits of what we're able to do. And they believe it's a lot easier for them to rein in inflation than to reverse disinflationary trends. And so, I do think at some point, and this is something that I think a lot of people are thinking about right now, is if in the past, the Fed would see these types of inflationary pressures building and would start to get ahead of them by raising interest rates and making sure they don't fall behind the curve of inflation. Now they've decided we're not doing that. We're going to let inflation rise and we're not going to try and head it off. And so what that creates is the potential for inflation to run really hot and the Fed to be way behind the curve. So what then do they have to do in order to rein in inflation if it proves to be not transitory? Well, then the Fed's going to have to go from the zero lower bound to, you know, raising, you know, by 50 basis points several times in a row, to 50, you know, 100, maybe 200, 250, 300 basis points in a short period of time in order to try and rein in inflation. Now, imagine if the Fed went, you know, in a 6-month period from zero to 300 basis points, what that would do to risk assets. It would create a major problem, I think, for the stock market, which has come to expect 0% interest rates forever. So I do think the Fed is playing with fire right now with inflation, and to pretend that they have the confidence that inflation will, you know, prove to be transitory is just a dangerous game.
Jesse, how likely is it, though, in your eyes, that the Fed does provide that big of a shift in policy and goes from zero to, 300 basis points, even 200 basis points in a short period of time? Is that actually going to happen in your eyes?
Yeah, if we start seeing inflation numbers, you know, a year from now, when these base effects are clearly gone and we have inflation running 3%, 4%, 5%, the Fed is going to be forced to do something about that. And because the risk is, and this is really what the Fed has been trying to do, is Paul Volcker was incredibly successful in breaking the inflationary mindset. He convinced not only Americans, but the world that he was going to do whatever it takes to rein in inflation. And he created a lot of credibility for the Fed by he did that. He broke the back of inflation. And then, you know, since that time, everybody's believed the Fed will never let inflation get out of control again. And it's really those inflationary expectations that are more important than inflation because they can be self-fulfilling. So when people start believing that disinflation is the trend, they say, I don't need to buy something today. It might be cheaper, you know, next year, you know, whether that's an iPad or whatever. But when the inflationary mindset changes and people start believing, wait a second, maybe I need to buy something today because, next month, next year, you know, the price is going to be more expensive. That mindset changes as a result of inflationary, you know, people seeing inflation, whether it's in lumber or home prices or anything. That can become self-fulfilling where people say, okay, I need to buy today in order to get ahead of rising prices. I think we're seeing that in the real estate market right now, and that's what's creating such a frenzy in residential real estate. But if you see that type of mindset transition from asset prices to the real economy, that's where the Fed is going to have this problem, where you know, this inflationary mindset has changed. People no longer believe the Fed is going to rein in inflation. We're going to have, let's fill up the gas tank today because tomorrow it'll be more expensive. Let's but you know, buy extra groceries today, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the Fed will have to, you know, will be forced to deal with inflation running 4, 5, 6%.
So then, Jesse, as this all carries over to the markets, look, it's been a good ride for markets, even for commodities. You take a long enough time frame here, especially from the start of the pandemic and that washout, everything's doing well. Obviously, there's a lot more money in the system, but how do you see markets moving forward from here?
Well, you know, the markets, you know, for risk assets, you know, mainly primarily the stock market, is most, I think, you know, attuned to this discussion over asset purchases. And everybody's kind of on pins and needles waiting to see when the Fed is going to start talking about tapering, because we all know that they're going to start talking about it well in advance of doing it. That's something that, you know, Jay Powell has said. You know, Powell was on the FOMC, you know, when they started tapering in 2013, and he was one of the members that was advocating for tapering back then, and he saw what happened with the taper tantrum. And so I think what he has said, you know, is that he's going to address that by giving advance notice, you know, well in advance. So they're going to talk about tapering well before that they're going to do it. They're not going to just say, hey, you know, in the next several months, we're going to start tapering. He's going to say, you know, hey, 9 months from now, six, 9 months from now, we're going to start tapering is probably. And so, you know, I think that the market is waiting to hear that. Like, you know, we've talked about many times, Corey, the stock market is a discounting mechanism. It likes to discount, you know, a year or 18 months into the future. And so, you know, I think that's what the market is doing right now is looking at the Fed and saying, hey, you know, we're probably going to get a rate hike by the end of next year. That's what the markets are pricing in right now, which means we're probably going to get tapering sometime in the next, you know, 12 months or maybe even sooner. You know, they might need to start tapering by the end of this year. And so, you know, if you think about that and kind of walk backwards from that, you know, they need to start talking about tapering here almost any day now to give the markets a good 6 months notice before they start doing it.
How important is it to look around the world, too, and see what other central banks are doing and how other countries' economies are faring during this?
Yeah, you know, I think there is, you know, some lag between, obviously, I mean, you know, a country like India that is seeing case counts just absolutely explode and is not, you know, able to manage, you know, the virus as well as some other places. Yeah, the recovery is going to be staggered, and that's going to make a difference to, you know, investors in those areas. But I do think what the markets are discounting now is that it looks, you know, from the way the vaccine rollout is happening here in the U.S. and even, you know, Israel's kind of probably a good example for the rest of the world, that we are going to get past this. And that's really the optimism in the markets, you know, that's being expressed right now is, you know, it's the inverse of the fear that we saw a year ago when, you know, we were just learning about the virus, markets crashed, everybody's worried it was going to be a major, you know, blow to the economy. And it turns out, you know, we did have a V recovery in the economy and in earnings. And so, you know, I think that's probably what markets are pricing in around the world.
So when it comes to investing then, Jesse, look, like I think you are right in the sense that fear has left the markets, and as COVID gets a little bit more under control and people are maybe more optimistic, and will we see that reflected in the markets plus spending habits of individuals? But in terms of investing right now, it's impossible to tell somebody to go out and short these markets because they would have just been run over this last year. But where do you stand in terms of finding some investments and some opportunities out there?
First of all, I have to disagree with you. I think the markets have been a great place for shorting over the last few months. You just have to be very tactical. And to me, you know, you look at the all these stay-at-home stocks, you know, that did so well. These have been great shorts over the past few months, whether it's Zoom or Peloton or any. I mean, you know, the ARK Innovation Fund has been, you know, a wonderful thing to try and trade from the short side. More recently, you know, small caps have gone nowhere since February. I think that's an area where we can look to be tactically short, because small caps are just obscenely overvalued right now. If you think about, you know, what has benefited most from the reopening trade, it's been small caps. And I do think probably what we're looking at going forward is not just inflation, but stagflation. You listen to all these companies that are talking about supply constraints, and they're also, you know, I mean, all the automakers are shutting down production. So their costs are going up and they can't produce vehicles. And so that is not great for the economy. It's not great for their earnings. And they're just, you know, probably the prime example of a trend that's happening to a lot of companies right now. And so I do think there are opportunities on the short side. But to me, you know, inflation is here. The numbers are going to start reflecting it in the next few months. And to me, I don't think, when I'm doing a lot of this research, I keep coming back to the conclusion, I can't own enough gold right now. That it's so out of favor right now. And with inflation picking up, there's no way that Jay Powell is going to be able to allow the long end of the curve to keep up with inflation over the next few months. And I don't think it probably would anyways. But, you know, we're looking at, you know, 1.5% on the 10-year, 2.25% on the 30-year treasury. If inflation is going to go 3%, 4%, or 5% over the next, you know, few months and couple of quarters, you know, that's going to mean that 30-year yield is significantly negative in real terms, which is incredibly bullish for the gold price. And, you know, to me, gold has had a very healthy correction since last summer. We're entering into the seasonally strong period of the year for gold prices. It's out of favor. We've seen massive outflows out of gold ETFs. Just as all of these fundamentals are lining up for, you know, to push the price higher, I think we could see gold scream higher over the next few months.
Now, is that going to go in the face of other commodities that maybe need a pullback or a broad market pullback? How does that happen in a big picture sense here, looking at some of the other sectors?
I do think we're probably very close to a pullback in the equity markets. Probably all of these reopening trades are a little overheated, overdone right now. So even commodities probably could pull back some. But, you know, I hesitate to say that because I do believe we are the early stages of a commodity super cycle, but that doesn't mean there can't be, you know, significant corrections, you know, and pullbacks. We could be near one of those for the commodity markets right now. It just seems like so many people have bought into this idea of a commodity super cycle. Bullishness towards, you know, copper and a lot of other things has you know, gotten pretty extreme. And so I wouldn't be surprised at all to see a pullback in these things. But, you know, like I said, I do think we're not just looking at inflation, but we're looking at a stagflationary period. You know, after the base effects for GDP wear off, you know, we're going to fall back to, you know, 2-3% GDP growth at best, you know, going forward. And if you have, you know, inflation running significantly higher than that, I mean, it's negative growth in real terms. That's not, you know, a healthy situation. And you know, markets, probably stagflation is the worst environment to own financial assets like stocks and bonds. And it's probably one of the best environments you can imagine for precious metals. And so I do think that's probably where we're headed. And if so, if you get stagflation with some form of yield curve control or something like that, I mean, that is an incredibly bullish setup for the gold price. And it's just so ironic to me that gold is so out of favor right now when the setup for it, the fundamental, you know, setup going forward has rarely been as bullish as it is today.
Oh, and even after this 7+ month correction here, gold is still at a much higher level than it was for almost the last decade, or most of the last decade at least. Now, Jesse, I know that you follow a lot of the gold producers, the major gold miners. Is that where you're going to be focused, or are you looking in other sectors within the gold sector for investments?
You know, mainly, I like to own the metal directly for the majority of my position. I use the miners as kind of trading vehicles. And I just feel like right now, a lot of the research I'm doing, I just come to the conclusion I don't own enough of the precious metal directly in my portfolio. So yeah, I think it used to be the Central Fund of Canada. It's now the Sprott Physical Gold and Silver ETF. That thing trades, it's been trading at 5-6% discount to its net asset value for the last few months, which to me, if you can buy the metals at a 5% discount, that's a pretty nice bargain, especially when I think fair value for the gold price is, well above the current level.
All right, Jesse, we'll wrap it up there. Always great having you on the show, buddy. I enjoy reading over everything you publish out of the Felder Report, and I always appreciate you taking some time and sharing all of your thoughts with our listeners. Have a great rest of your weekend, Jesse. We'll chat again in another few weeks.
Thanks, Corey.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.